Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to The Schmidt List, the podcast for people dedicated to managing successful projects, developing impactful products, and building engaged teams. And now, here's your host, Kurt Schmidt.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 45. This week, I want to share with you the audio from the live show that we did on October 1st. If you were able to come out to the show, thank you for your support. I really appreciate it. But if you weren't, I have the audio for you today. I want to thank Sarita, Kristen, and Brian for joining me for the live show. And I also want to thank everyone who brought their questions. It was truly a lively discussion. I want to thank Foundry and WeWork for providing a lot of free drinks for everyone. That was a lot of fun. And speaking of drinks, a special thanks to Fulton for helping this all come together. So let's not waste any more time and let's get right into the show. But right before we do, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for listening and thank you for your support. I really hope you enjoy this episode and we'll see you next week.
Okay, everybody, we're going to get this party started right now. Woo! Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Means so much. Thank you. Yeah, Monday. So I am really excited because I have an amazing panel that's joining me today. This is a subject that I've been passionate about for a very, very long time. It took me a long time even to figure out what the words were for it, what it actually meant, right? So I wanted just to tell a quick little story about my journey, and then we're going to jump right into our discussion about this theme for tonight. Because it's important that we understand, why do we want influence? Why is influence important, right? Isn't it just another way of saying manipulating people, right? Yeah. No. No, it's not. So, real quick, a long time ago, I had to do their annual review. Now, I didn't hire this person. They had gotten hired previously before I had started at the company. And I had to do their annual review, and they walked in and they said, hey, I've been here for a year, and I'm ready to find out what you're going to give me for being here a year. And I said, well, I've got a lot of good feedback from your peers, and here's an increase and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, and that's basically all we're going to do. And they said, well, but I've been here a year. You should move me to a senior role. And I said, well, I don't know what that means. You've been here a year, so you should be a senior. I went down and explained to them, what did it mean to actually be a senior in our organization? A senior is a person who mentors, who helps people, who looks out for problems, does all these things. And that person just turned at me and said, well, I'm not interested in politics. And I said, I literally was speechless. I was like, but that's not politics. I didn't know what to say. Because they technically, I mean, I guess they're not wrong. I mean, who wants to get involved in politics, right? But again, this is about the way that we get our work done. Each of you has to go to work every single day and try to get things done. You don't get things done by yourself. You have to influence others to get things done. It isn't just the people in your team either. It's people across an organization. It's people who have a completely different job than you. You can't get your stuff done without influencing them. And it can't be just because you're in charge, right? You can't just, a title does not equal leadership. So that's what we're gonna talk about tonight. And so my distinguished panels, Sarita, Brian, and Kristen, welcome. Thank you. Woo! So I wanted to start with my first question to Kristen, because we had a little chat about this at our pregame. Are office politics inherently bad? Is it bad to partake in politics in the office?
Well, I would say the word politics itself has become really a negative word, and I think that may be an outcome of people feeling manipulated as being at the end of bad politics. But when I think about politics as running for office in an actual company, it's really opportunity. So if you've ever worked in a really tiny company where somebody just tells you what to do, they're in charge, and that's that, your opportunity is really small. But when you work in a bigger company and you have the opportunity to lead and influence other people, to see an idea that you have the opportunity to motivate a group of people, and that can be huge, whether it's at a company, in the city, in a country. And so I think that politics is really an opportunity. I like that. And not inherently bad.
Yeah, and so, but again, if I want that opportunity, shouldn't it just show up if I get my job done, right? Right, Sarita? Like, if I'm getting my work done, why don't I just get, why doesn't it just rain promotions on me?
Raises,
yeah.
Money.
First of all, I heard that people are going to heckle Brian. Is that, are
yes.
there people here to heckle Brian?
Very good. Very
Look
good.
At these hands, I love it.
Yeah, I paid a lot for those people, so let's just...
Yeah, I mean, I think people do think, like, okay, here's my job description, here it is, here's what I'm here to do. And, you know, business hires you to do that work, but when you really think about the impact that you can have, like, I think it's important to know that influence is really, like, the sort of aura that you have. It's not just about the work that you can produce, it's about how you help other people help this business, help this culture, help this community. And one of the things that I thought we were going to ask early on, or one of the questions that really stuck in my mind, is this idea that, like, is influence naturally sort of, is it inherently manipulative? Is it sort of like knowing what things about people and sort of using what you know against them? And I think influence is actually rooted in good. Influence is intended to be something where you can actually help a business grow, right? And so part of that is knowing the difference between maybe persuasion and influence. So when you persuade somebody, that's typically a very transactional thing. You can use manipulation in persuasion situations, but you can't use it very often. Like, you know, at a certain point, people know that you're manipulating them and they stop. But influence is about, like, cultivating a reputation, cultivating relationships so that people really trust you. They know that you're objective, and that when they come to you, that you're not thinking about just you. Because I think that is the number one influence killer, is when people think that you are only in it for yourself or only in it for your team. Then you're never going to have influence. And so it's about figuring out how to make sure that your wake, the sort of impact that you have, is much, much bigger than yourself. Brian, what do you think?
Oh.
Heckle him.
Nice pants, Martin.
Oh, cheers, mate. Cheers. Yes, thank you. I think of influence in terms of that sphere of influence, too. So is it that the four of us, and there's this, you know, radiant light over our heads, and there's this pool of illumination that kind of surrounds the four of us? We have sort of a nice space in which the four of us can then influence and nudge like actors in a system, and that interplay is going to determine ultimately what happens in that system. I think part of what I heard and what you were sharing is there's that sense, too, of for the greater purpose, that aim, that North Star that an organization might be shooting for, you can extend that pool of radiance beyond just yourself. And the idea being to not shine more light on oneself, but include more people in it. And you can really sense that when people do that well. And the people I've seen that, influencers that do it extremely well, give me this palpable sense of the ability to amplify what people around them are trying to do, as opposed to diminish, dampen, or elevate one in expense of the other, and that amplification is just really clear, and it's kind of equivalent to that same kind of pool of radiance that they share. And I know that sounds a little touchy-feely, it's not meant to, but it's just one of those metaphor that in my head helps me kind of break that apart from politicking in that negative sense.
Yeah, I think of it as like a ripple effect. Yeah. Like the radiance is sort of the same concept, or the aura, just sort of like that, it's more than like this being that you are, that it sort of emanates out.
Right.
But it's touchy-feely, for sure, because like transactional manipulation. I was just thinking about this as this panel was upcoming, and I was thinking about sales that are like buy one get one free, 25% off, or some type of deal, and that is really a manipulation on you to buy quicker, sooner. Or if you have two cameras and you've done the research and they're like, oh, you get a free memory card, that's a manipulation on a transactional sales type. And it's not inherently bad. It's maybe like going to not build loyalty for that brand, but it's going to drive their business for that month or that quarter. But on the other side, I was thinking about brands where you really actually sacrifice to like be loyal to that brand. And so I was just thinking about this the other day because I love Patagonia. They have a daycare on site. They close their stores for voting. And this isn't even an advertisement for Patagonia, but like I will drive all the way across town to shop there. I will buy my kids' stuff there, even though I know they'll grow out of it in 2 months. And it's a higher price point. So it's like, oh, what do I sacrifice to buy that? Because I believe in the brand and I'm loyal to the brand, as opposed to them running a sale. And so they've built this loyalty over time by who they are and what values they have. So it's like, that's inspiring to me. That's not, that doesn't make me feel manipulated. It makes me feel like I want to follow them. And then they send me emails about hiking and I want to go on their trip. You know, it's a sense of belonging to a movement or a something. So it is really touchy-feely. Yeah,
the one thing I think was really powerful for me, you know, when my father used to always say that, you know, people try so hard to be understood before they try to be understanding, right? And the thing that I learned, though, when I got older is that people kept telling me that I need to be empathetic. Like, well, you need to be empathetic. You need to have empathy. And I'd be like, but I don't like this person. I don't like him. But what I learned is that you don't have to like somebody to be empathetic. You don't. It's a good trick, I'm telling you. You can actually go. You can actually walk a mile in somebody else's shoe and not have to like take the shoes home and care for them and feed them. I don't know, whatever I'm saying right
can
now.
Can I respond? Go ahead, yeah, I totally agree with that. I think, you know, I've seen this so many times when people think like, they think, okay, I'm going to be a great understander. First seek to understand before being understood. But they'll listen with this, they have this inner dialogue in their head, and I know you've all seen it. Like, you'll see people where they're like, well, what do you think about this? And in their head, they're thinking, you're so stupid. How'd you ever get this job? You know, you're incompetent. You know, and they're just like this dialogue. And the problem with that, I mean, there's so many problems with that. It's disrespectful to begin with. But when you do that, it leaks. Like, you can think that you're saying the right things, and you have composure, and you're...
Yeah, you're not slick.
But you're not, right. But it, like, people, they read your nonverbal cues. And if you think someone's stupid, they're going to know that you think they're stupid. And so it's, you know, on top of being disrespectful, it just doesn't work. And so if you, this is something that I work on, because I'm a very judgmental person. I've worked very hard on not being judgmental.
Are you an ENTJ?
I am.
Oh my gosh, I knew it. So am I. They're so rare, and I can always find another ENTJ. I knew it.
That's so funny. Okay.
So, ENFP.
I don't even know what that means, actually. Okay.
But. Well, because ENTJ has a really strong J at the end. So like when you're taking in information...
I'm a strong J.
Strong junction. Yeah. Yeah, and you have to learn to hone that, right? It's not inherently bad.
Right, because at the same time, my goal is to be kind and loving and compassionate. And, you know, being judgmental and being compassionate, those two things are at odds. And so so my rule of thumb, for I'm sure this is for many people, is that when you're chatting with somebody, and if you really want to be an active, curious listener, that means listening to the words they say, looking at their nonverbal cues, their body language, the tone of their voice, and then as best as you can, stopping that dialogue. So everything in your head that's like, you know, the soundtrack. For mine, my soundtrack is like, it's manifest as Phil from Modern Family. Do you guys know Phil from Modern Family? He's like constantly talking. He does not shut up. You know, that's the guy for me. So quiet him and just listen. And it's very, very hard to do. But I think that is part of influence, is that sincere ability to not just pretend you're listening or not have people feel like they're heard, that they are actually legitimately heard.
So how do I become sincere when I'm not sincere?
It's hard. Yeah.
Like I'm really struggling because I don't understand what this team does, but I know that if they don't get their job done, I'm kind of screwed, and I need to go over there, but I've got all this work to do. I've got all this stuff. I've got a boss I got to deal with, and now I've got to go and be sincere and have empathy for these folks.
And stop thinking they're stupid.
And stop thinking they're stupid.
Well, as a people leader, right, like you're designing the org, and when you design teams that can work together and speak with one another to get and yield the best outcome, you have a motivation and a goal that you're trying to reach, and so you can start to think about it more like a business opportunity to really understand people and be empathetic. So I am one of those people who totally buys into like strength finders and understanding people's strengths and their weaknesses, or Belbin, where you figure out, okay, like the four of us have different set types and styles, and how can we work together? And yeah, I totally buy into it. Like the whole ENTJ, the Myers-Briggs, where you understand how people take in information and process information, and understanding that's really important. So as somebody who's always worked with a lot of developers and in software, I am an ENTJ, and when I did my Myers-Briggs, it stands for extrovert, and on the extrovert, I was 100, like 100. And then I took it again, and it was still 100. And in my undergrad classes, where I first came across Myers-Briggs, and they had us all take the test, and then we each had to go into different parts of the room depending on what you were, and here I was standing alone as an ENTJ, and the professor was like, brilliant, because that's really what it's like. There's not many of you. And so then kind of getting to know my other classmates and how they took in information, it's like, oh, you're 100% introverted. So me coming at you with all this energy is probably not going to help you do your best. And then when you start to kind of match other people or match people together, take away tasks that are not in somebody's skill set. Like my bottom for StrengthFinders is consistency. So if you give me a job that you ask me to do the same thing every day, I am literally not dumb. I can understand the concept, but it is really hard for me to execute, probably because my brain has a fill back there.
I used to run an operations team, and I felt like every day, like your goal in operations is to be like every day is 0.01% better than the day before. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it was that scene in Office Space where the guy says like, every day is just worse than the day before. You know that scene? Yeah. Yeah, I'm also not consistent.
But yeah, if you take those tasks away from people, they appreciate that because they don't enjoy tasks they're not good at. And nobody enjoys coming to work and not doing their best or not feeling fulfilled or feeling like they can contribute. And so the minute you start taking away those tasks, there's somebody else there that is their strength. And so kind of exercising that has made me be more understanding and empathetic as a people leader. And yeah, starting to see results from that.
Well, and Kurt, you had asked, how do you do this? How do you actually show up and be sincere, right?
Yeah.
You have to have just enough dollop of courage to reach down and say, I'm going to choose in this moment to be somewhat vulnerable. Mm-hmm. As a leader, that's really, really, really scary, right? But opening up that channel of vulnerability taps into your own self-awareness. That, again, radiates. It's that ripple. And it actually gives you enough pause to kind of check that assumption that's kind of rattling around in your head, like that soundtrack in the back. And you might actually hear what someone is saying. So whether or not you're saying, well, I'm going to show up being sincere and all that, attempting instead to show up and being open enough to just be a tiny bit vulnerable, and that could be putting out a gaffe, you know, expressing the thing that you don't know, showing someone that you're comfortable saying, this isn't a strength, like you were just sharing with us. Those, for me, are practical examples of just expressing and practicing a little bit of vulnerability. And that goes a long way, as opposed to instead practicing or putting on the mask of sincerity, which I think is a lot harder task.
I've framed it as generosity. Like, that's been the way that has been the thing that's most helped me, is to look at it, to, you know, this political climate, like, you know, you're either A or you're B. There's not a lot of in between. And so it's very easy to be like, person thinks B, they're an idiot. And so I think it's like finding that thread of humanity. Like, you know, you're human, I'm human. We think very different things. it takes so much practice. But I actually feel like it it feels better when you look at it as generosity, because it just feels like, okay, I am doing a, like, there's sort of a sense of peace that comes with that. But I will also say meditation and, like, deep breathing and all of those sorts of things. Because you do. You work with people routinely where you're like, part of your brain is like, I think I hate you. And you're like, that's not okay. It's not okay to feel that way. So, like, find this, like, shred of, like, you know, you're human and I'm human and we have that in common. Okay. And then even when people are saying things, you know, if they're saying, like, well, gravity doesn't exist where I am. And you're like, ugh. Gravity exists where you are. I promise there's gravity. But
you're,
you
talking
know,
about sales?
I am, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I knew you were. Yeah, oh, well, that's what you get. No, I think that's a really good point. I think the hard thing, though, is that, I mean, everybody's so busy, and to take a moment to think, like, I could just run right through these people if I have to, and I will just get the job done. And, you know, may the bridges I burn light the way, you know, like, let's just go and get all this work done, and then I'll feel good, right? Because I've built up all this stuff. I've got all the work done, right? But the thing that I learned is that it's the legacy you leave, okay, right? That you leave when you leave a job or you move on to other places. So for me, it's about really connecting with those folks, other than it is just the work you get done. It's the work you get done together. I look out in this audience, there's a bunch of people here I've worked with in the past. And it's not about, I forget what projects they were and who it was for and how much money was made or not made, or what exploded, what didn't explode. It probably exploded, but that's not, it's the experience that we've shared, and that's the important thing. But again, like, what I see more and more these days is that people are not investing themselves into the other people around them because they might be in a different job or in a different spot.
Well, you could also turn it around and think about it as user experience. So, like, user experience is about the way somebody feels when they're using your product about themselves. So, like, if somebody's using your product and they feel frustrated, your user experience is making them feel bad about themselves. And if your user experience makes somebody feel good about themselves, they inherently are more likely to like your product, right? So if you think about yourself as a product and you make people feel good about themselves when they interact with you, you know, your reputation and your legacy and those type of things will go on a lot longer, and you'll find different ways, like, down the path, you'll be glad you did it that way, right? So taking that extra moment to think about, like, what that person's user experience is talking to you, like, do they feel good about themselves in the interaction? And taking that extra moment sometimes pays, I think, a lot of dividends.
What's a natural force multiplier, too?
Yeah.
So, Kurt, you were saying, well, why would I? Because I'm trying to, you know, each question and each step here, I'm trying to think practical, practical, practical. So I'm a person that is leading people. There's a team. There's work to be done. It's kind of easy to say, and I got things done. I ticked boxes. I made stuff. I wrote documents. Oftentimes, that isn't actually the outcome. The behavior change, the way that you pivot, the way that a group of people start to start to collaborate more effectively, whatever that is, I always like to look for those force multipliers. Maybe it's me, maybe it's you, maybe it's another element of a process or lack of process or whatever it is, but those opportunities to invest that tiny bit of time to unlock whatever that force multiplier is. Because, I mean, dollars and cents, yo, that's going to pay off. It really is. So if someone's truly thinking in that frame of reference, that would be one of my kind of hopefully persuasive arguments, is to think about it dollars and cents wise. Look for those force multiplier opportunities. And it may require that little bit of investment of your time rather than treasure to find it.
You know, something that was really transformative for me like 20 years ago, I was reading this article, like, I was waiting for my sister to try on. She just had a baby and we were like in a maternity place, and she's trying on nursing bras. And so I'm like waiting for her, and there's a Harvard Business Review. It's the first time I'd ever picked up a Harvard Business Review. It was like such an odd series of events. And there was this article about jerks and lovable idiots. And, you know, it's classic HBR style. It was a quadrant. And the idea was, like, on the scale of likability, so there's, like, jerks on one end and then, like, super likable people on the other end. And then the other axis was really incompetent and, like, you know, incredibly most brilliant person you've ever met, right? And so the top right quadrant is a superstar. You know, everybody wants to work with a superstar. And the bottom left quadrant was the incompetent idiot, mean incompetent idiot. Nobody wants to work with that person. But the thing that was interesting was that the lovable incompetent person, the guy that you liked being with, was more sought after than the brilliant jerk. And I mean, it actually, like, this whole thing was that competency is actually second to likability. And so likability isn't just like, can you get a beer with this guy? Like, I mean, it really does mean that your character has to be something that's really, that really stands strong, that people trust you and all of those sorts of things. But I thought that was, like, that transformed how I interacted with people. Not that I was an idiot jerk before that, but I felt like, I was like, oh, yes, there is value to just, you know, finding the humanity in the people around you.
So Sarita, can you point to something that you actually consciously chose to do differently because of that new perspective?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I really do routinely, like if I'm going to have a conversation with someone that I know is going to be a difficult conversation, someone that I actually really truly believe I dislike, like I do, I like do box breathing. I don't know if you guys know box breathing. It's like breathing in 4, holding your breath. Like I do all of these sort of like techniques to really just be conscious and present because I need it. Because if I fall into my old patterns, I am very judgmental and I will think that, you know, I really will think like I really don't like you. I don't have any interest in making you successful. You know, I have those sorts of thoughts, so I have to be really conscious. I say all of this because, I mean, it makes me sound like I struggle to do these things. I mean, at this point, it's relatively natural, but, you know, it is easy. Like, if you're a sharp person and you do well and you are used to people kind of just doing what you say, you have these expectations, right? And that doesn't work. I mean, that doesn't scale as a leader. It doesn't build loyalty with your colleagues. You know, you don't feel good about yourself when you do those things. So, you know, the standard that you hold yourself to has to be one where every day you look in the mirror and you feel like, okay, you know what, I really walk the walk and I talk the talk and I feel like as best as I can, I do the things that I intend to do. It takes a lot of work. And I mean, it really is like physical tactics, like breathing and meditation and removing yourself when you need to remove yourself, all of those things.
So one thing that I started doing 6 years ago when I became a mother was when I would talk to somebody, it was too hard for me not to think about like them having a parent or like this is somebody's child, and it kind of made me feel like I want someone to be kind to my child down the road and to be patient with him and guide him to his next experience. So yeah, that had a lot of impact on me, and it really makes me think about how I treat people because they belong to somebody else, family or friends. And then the other thing is when you have to let somebody go, that is something that I never want to do. So I take really careful care in hiring because it's very important for like setting people up for success. But if you inherit somebody, that you wouldn't have hired. Yeah. And even when they're a total jerk, like I inherited this guy once and he said to me in our first one-on-one, he was like, oh yeah, I don't do any work actually. And I was, I'm sorry, what? And then he looked at me like, oh shit. Like I mean, I do work. And I was like, oh yeah, I got a list of things for you to do. Yeah, and so, but still, even as much as I didn't like that guy, I had to let him go eventually, and it was unpleasant, and I still went home and felt really terrible, because I just think about that person being a human being and going home and having lost their job, and so that's what kind of breeds a lot of empathy for me, is thinking about the human connections that they have outside of our experience right here.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing that I learned. I mean, when I was much younger and had my first job, like kind of leading a team, I wanted everybody to be my friend. I thought that was gonna be great. We're gonna have this great experience and we're all gonna be friends and we're gonna go have beers and be friends and we're gonna work on stuff and be friends. And then it all like dismantled, right? And I was like, what's going on, right? We thought we were friends. Like, why didn't you finish your stuff? Because we're friends. Like, you know what I mean? It just, it's because, yeah, we're friends. Like, why do I have to finish my stuff?
See, it's like the guy who didn't do work.
Yeah.
The person before me, he reported to, they had an agreement.
Oh, they had agreement.
Agreement that because he just didn't
friends.
Have to work. Because they were friends.
Because they were friends, right? That's pretty great.
You should see the things I found in his desk after he left.
I don't.
He had like a mirror up to see if people work.
We're just coming, just so he can shut off his video game, close the tab or something. That's great. The thing is that what I found, though, is that in order for people to feel like they actually got value at work, there was some discipline and there was some constraints. They needed to know what good looked like, but they also needed to know what not good looked like. And I think that it's a difficult conversation because you don't want to go in and be like, and this is what it takes for you to like not be here anymore. And you don't want to have that conversation, right? And you especially don't want to have it nice and early when they're new there and you want them to still be excited about working with you, right? But I think that's the important time to actually have those conversations.
Yeah, and when you have those conversations, you can still have empathy. Like I've let several people have, you know, like I've had to have those conversations either in this isn't working, here are the steps to get to where it's going to work. And I actually am really surprised. I've had a lot of people thank me afterwards, like, wow, I was kind of not inspired and now I see the things that I need to do. And I've seen people like turn it around and I'm like, oh, I actually like you. You know, back from, right. Wow, why are you not working?
Right. Yeah, no, I think again, going back to what you were saying, Sarita, is being conscious and present. Because it's really easy when you start to get into an uncomfortable situation or it feels like it could be uncomfortable to just start shutting down parts of you, right? And be thinking about what are you going to do later and what did you, you know, oh, I shouldn't have had a burger, like, yeah. You know, right? Like,
you fall into old patterns.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And so I think that's super important that you have to practice being present, because it's really easy to just shut down and just go through the motions, right? Oh, okay, well, you're, you know, in charge of this area that I don't get along with, and I got to have this conversation with you, and so I'm only going to, like, put my foot in the door and, like, talk to you and then leave, right? And I can just tell everybody, yeah, I talked to them, right? And then nothing got done.
That stuff kept me awake at night more times than I care to admit. I think the tonic I finally found to get my head out of that was considering the individual versus the village. So if I was going to have one of those, you know, air quotes, hard conversations with somebody, you know, you're kind of building up all this almost like emotional armor and you're ready for battle. And then I kind of reminded myself a couple key things. One, it's not about me. That helps a lot. That's something I have to practice every single day. It's not about me. And then also realize that I'm probably doing a disservice to the individual not to have the conversation, and then I'm also potentially doing a disservice to the village that they're a part of, be it org, team, group, you know, work stream, whatever it is, that depend on those interrelationships working. And this is a function that is not congruent with the people in their work being effective. And so there's this extra opportunity to then depersonalize it in a sense that it's like, well, it's not about me. It might not even be about her. It might be about this greater village I'm trying to serve in near term and longer term by having this conversation. And that just helped me structure, I think, like you said, how do you get to green? What's that path forward? That set of lenses really helped me even think what a path forward might look like. So.
Yeah, and even the group politics, a lot of times if it's one group that doesn't like another group, it's easy to be in your team or your group and you disband from a meeting, or it's like, oh, we have to work with them. This is going to be so difficult. It's always so difficult. There's a huge opportunity in that to reach out to one person, someone on that team, and have like coffee or get together and figure out what their pain points are. Because a lot of times in any relationship, if you say, hey, look, I'm really sorry. Here's where I messed up. The other person is far more likely to say, actually, it's not all you. Here's where I did this, that, and the other thing. And I think that's a really effective technique that's taken a lot of years of practice, but I use it a lot in my marriage, too. it really works. It's like the minute I apologize, like my partner apologizes back to me, and then we're having a constructive conversation, and I think that's what's made like a relationship that I really enjoy being in, because I know that we are respectful to each other, and I think that that can be built over teams too. And that usually just starts with one conversation and say, you know, we're always late with our stuff and it's kind of downstream. This is what happens and this is the chain effect. And so we're going to work on this part. Do you think you could work on this part with us? It's like, how do we become one team that's trying to get to one goal as opposed to us and them? The us and them is always a bad recipe for disaster for what people, I think, call politics that are like, gives it a bad connotation.
Thanks for that. I think that's a really nice concrete example of how to stand in inquiry as a practice. Meaning, rather than disagreement, you're inviting like shared exploration. And that's just a great way to diffuse that sort of combative stance. Like you were saying earlier, it's so human to be judgy. It's so easy to be judgy. Taking that moment to turn that into self-reflection instead. I had a friend, dear friend, we were at a bar, we were listening to some jazz musician, shoes off, bare feet, tapping on the carpet, banging away on this keyboard. In my mind, it was just so not engaging. And I started to get really bristly, and my hackles are going up, and I'm watching all these 20-somethings getting into it, and I'm like, what the f*** is this? Come on, get out of here with this shit. This is, what are you talking about? And I really started to bristle at this, and Dan goes, Brian, it says a lot more about you than it says about this cat, you know, how you're reacting. And I'm like, oh, thank you for taking me out of my head and reminding me of that. And so I think of that night all the time when I'm trying to remind myself to do those things, to diffuse and create shared exploration that way.
It's hard. It's like yoga and meditation. It's a practice. Like, you don't just achieve it and then you're there. You have to, like, it's an ongoing...
Yeah. It's like no one wakes up and says, oh, I've achieved Zen. I tried Zen and now I'm the Buddha. Yeah, it doesn't happen like that. It is years and years of work.
Yeah, well, about the other side, though, is that I've had other either peers or leaders or other people say, well, just treat them like adults. And then, like, that's the answer. Is like, treat them like adults.
Like adults?
Yeah.
Like people over 18?
Yeah, people over 18. Okay. That's what I assume that they mean when they say, I don't really understand what that means. Because again, like, there's a difference between, I feel like being able to be present and having those difficult conversations with people is treating people like adults, not just saying, do what you're going to do, and if you do step on something bad, then I'll scream and yell at you, because that's what adults do, right? It's like everything's fine until it's not, and now the house is on fire and we're all running into the street. Right?
But I just assume that when people have said, you know, treat so-and-so like an adult, I interpret that to remind myself there's a respect that I, you know, that this person is due. That maybe if I remain open to surprise, like this person could literally surprise me, I might surprise myself. They might actually do something in reaction to a plan or a way forward. They might actually do something if you bother to take a moment to be present and actively listen, like you were saying. And if I shut down that sense of surprise, then I'm not giving them even that modicum of respect that I think that they're owed, at least, to have that chance. And so that's where I think if I'm diminishing someone and making them childlike, I'm just pre-assuming that they're just never going to be able to do this.
But also, if someone shows you who they are, like, you should believe them.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, if somebody truly acts like a child, like, are you really supposed to keep treating them like an adult?
I don't know.
I think if you pay their salary, yeah.
Oh,
I
mean, yes.
I feel like, you know, if they're your employee... I've heard don't treat people or treat people like adults, I've thought typically that's like don't coddle them, don't overly nurture people, you know, let them sort of explore. But at the same time, I mean, these are all like, you know, we could spend a year on like sort of leadership development and influence and all those sorts of things. I mean, these are things that are skills that you develop, and you only develop really through exposure and practice and mistakes. But definitely, like, you know, in terms of feedback, I know you don't like the term feedback, but I always think of feedback as a gift. Like, so if you see that someone's really struggling with something, or if they're not meeting your expectations, you know, that's a form of influence. Like, how much they listen to you and how much they understand you. And a lot of that is really situational. It's understanding, you know, like, who is it that you're talking to and what words are important to them? Do they think in metaphors? Do they think in examples or whatever. And I also always think that, like, it's always important to be kind, too, because, like, sometimes people feel like when they give feedback, they're like, okay, you really suck at this. Well, that's not effective feedback. Like, people can't do anything with that. It just makes them feel badly. And so, you know, you don't want to be... There's a fine line between being sort of mean and giving constructive feedback. And so those are just things that you're, like, I will say, like, just through, like, mistakes and practice that you just learn from sort of doing. I don't know that there's necessarily... maybe it's a golden rule, like, how would you want someone to give you this kind of feedback? If you were in this situation, what would you want? I would actually say, just generally in terms of influence, I would say always, if you're trying to, as you're building relationships with people, you know, first stand in their shoes, and this goes back to understand them first. But that is, like, maybe rule number one, is to think, like, stand in this person's shoes. What's important to them? What does the world look like to them? What is their worldview? What do you know about them? Because that helps you interpret why are the things that are important to them important to them. And why are the and then you can ask yourself, why are the things that are important to me important to me? And then you get into the situation where you can find common ground, and you're like, you know, you like motherhood? I like motherhood. We have that in common. You like apple pie? I like apple pie. We have that in common. Like, you find some sort of common ground and build from there. But I, you know, back to this point about, like, storming in a room and being like, it's going to be X. Everybody be creative. Go design. Go be innovative. You know, like, that is, I don't know that that's ever worked. Yeah.
Hi.
The one thing that I've learned is that there isn't just two speeds to leadership. There's the way that people that I've talked to over and over again, they think of it like there's either superiority or there's inferiority. And this is the only two speeds I have at work, right? I'm either in a position where I have some sort of power and influence, or I'm not in that position. And the way that I learned to broach that over time was I kind of just, I mean, I've heard this before, but I kind of made up the word. It's like interiority, where... it's all about just, we're all on the same playing field. I don't care what your title is. I don't care if you're below me, above me, we're next to me, sideways, whichever. But I will never look at you as your title or your position, but as somebody I can learn something from. And if I can learn something from you, and I can also provide some sort of learning back to you, it places us both in this place of learning where now we're actually getting somewhere. Now we're actually engaged, and we're feeling like we are part of something, that we're here to actually have some sort of impact, right?
We're Americans. Americans are egalitarian by nature. Like, we, like, I'm always surprised when people level themselves down. Yeah. Like, when you, like, go into a room and you maybe think, oh, this person's so amazing, you put them on a pedestal. If you put someone on a pedestal, you put yourself down. So, again, it's really hard, but it just... you know, use that American mindset. Like, we, like, no one is better than anybody else in this country. So remind yourself, like, if you go in and you're chatting with the CEO and he's whatever number of levels above you, like, you are human and you're worth something, and they are paying your salary. There's a reason that you're here. Always remind yourself of that. Like, this person may be impressive and they may be amazing at all these things. So are you. You're amazing at a bunch of stuff. So, like, remind yourself. Like, don't level, I would say, I have like 100 different rules, but don't level yourself, don't level yourself down. Like, you know, walk into the room and, you know, I will not make any America jokes right now because it's too fragile. But remind yourself that, you know, we are a democracy.
Yeah. Woo! I like it. Yeah. I think that's really powerful what you just said, because if we're constantly trying to find where our position is instead of just determining who we are and what our position is, and don't get me wrong, just like you're saying, that takes work. You know, people always ask me sometimes, they're like, what's the first step at becoming a good leader? And I'm like, well, you know, it's the same if you want to lose weight. Like, you start hitting the gym, you know, it takes time. It's not something that you can just switch on or switch off. And to your point, Sarita, one of the greatest things I've learned over this past year of doing this show and talking with leaders and talking with other people is don't trust success.
That's right.
Just don't. People do that all the time. They're like, oh, this person is at this thing and they were in the newspaper and they have this and that. And so you assume they have their shit together, right? But they don't. They
They don't. They really don't.
You don't know. You don't know. Like, I had, when I was pregnant with my third child, I was at United Health Group, which some people here are from United Health Group. And there's this woman, I'll call her Roseanne. That's not her real name. Roseanne Jolenberg. And I was, like, pregnant with my third child. I was, like, 10 months pregnant. I was like a sphere. Like, imagine a grapefruit with, like, toothpicks for arms and legs. So I'm, like, waddling down the hallway. And I'm, like, getting to some meeting or something. And Roseanne, like, Roxanne, I'll call her Roxanne. Roxanne walks around the corner, and she's, like, in a pencil skirt. And, like, there was, I'm sure there was a wind machine blowing on her. Like, she had this platinum blonde hair and stilettos. And I was, like, I was wearing olive green Mary Jane Lands End tennis shoes. And I, what I did not realize was that my shirt didn't cover my belly, so I was exposed. The whole thing. And so I'm, like, waddling, and she whips around, and she's just been promoted to vice president. She's not even, like, 32 or something like that. And we were actually, just as a side note, the exact same age, exact same birth date, same year, everything. And I remember chatting with her, and she was like, well, I'm vice president. But I also learned that, you know, this sounds so bad now that I say this out loud.
Please do continue.
No, don't worry, we're not recording this.
Okay. In that grapefruit metaphor, I had a grape for a head. I actually do have a picture in my head. Anyway, she had recently been separated from her husband. She didn't have any children. And I was having my third children, and I had, like, actually been, my boss at the time had asked me to take a promotion, and I actually asked to step down and went down to part-time, or was going to go down to part-time after my third baby. And so in those situations, when you judge somebody and you're like, oh, this person has achieved so much at a certain age, you don't know the backstory. And in her case, she told me the backstory. And of course, like, if you were to ask me, you know, would you take a happy marriage and three healthy children over a title? Who wouldn't say, of course, that's a no-brainer, right? But so, like, what you see is just that little thing that you see. And it's not a representation of anything else. And don't make assumptions. Again, back to, you know, this is American, we're egalitarians. Like, that person excelled at that one thing. That's, like, that's all you know.
That's good. Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions. We want to make it a little bit more about everybody. But first, because I did such a piss-poor job of introducing folks, I just wanted to give you a moment to just say who you are and where you're from. Or where you're doing. Just go ahead.
Sarita Parikh. I don't know if you know this, I have three children.
Surprise.
Yeah. I work with Pearson Education, and I work in a division that's focused on helping adults who didn't finish high school earn their high school diplomas. It's a business where we have a mission. If our mission does well, our business does well. So I feel very, very grateful to do that kind of work.
I'm Brian Rowe. I'm currently a consumer experience architect at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. You can ask me later what that means because I still don't know. I have had the career path that I would never, ever, ever advocate anyone else do, which is curvilinear. It doesn't go anywhere. It probes into every dark, pointless corner of IT to jazz to, yeah, stupid stuff. So I will say, though, yeah, and these pants, exactly. But I will say this. If I can give any cred to myself, it's that I turned a theater major as my undergraduate, and I've parlayed that time and time and time and time again into business value for people. And so I will never tell theater majors that because they'll just never believe me. But if that gives you any kind of frame of reference.
I'm Kristen Womack, and I've lived here for about 13 years. So I'm a transplant to Minnesota. And I run a company called Hack the Gap. You might have heard of it. It's an all-women hackathon. I'm also building another company called Hello Mom, which is a video platform for connecting lactation professionals with new families. And on the side, to keep all that going, I also do software consulting in product management, APIs, strategy, and if you asked me to build your website, I'd probably do that. So I... Yeah, and I also wanted to say I went to school for sign language interpreting, and I still feel like it brings value today in product management, technology, and leadership, business, and so theater major. I had to take a theater class, too. Almost switched majors then. So, yeah.
It's perfect. Thank you. I will just edit this at the beginning of the show so it sounds...